You're listening to Around Comics, episode 255, brought to you by InStockTrades.com and Netflix. There's a pull in the heart tonight, in the heart of Texas. They shout it to them dark sights. We are rolling home. They shout an angel in their flight. From Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you are in the area, please drop by. Hey there, folks. Christopher Niesman here. We'll get you introduced to this new panel on Around Comics. First of all, as always, is Mr. Tom Caters.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Thomas. How are you?
I'm great.
Did you take a boat here?
No, I did. I was very conscious of cars like splashing water on me, though. I was very careful to keep my eye out for, and I avoided it.
It is 27 out of 31 days that we've had rain.
The sun's overrated. You don't need it.
It's too bad, because it was actually warm out today.
Yeah. After October 1st, I don't expect to see the sun until like May, so it doesn't matter. Our next guest right here is the voice of Word Balloon, Mr. John
Sundress. In our own kind of ray of sunshine.
Yes, you are the
hello.
You're the only sun I need, John.
October 1st, the only sun I get is when John is around.
The Doug Henning of Comic Book Podcast. Yes. So wonderful to see all of you. Hello.
You need to grow your hair longer.
Yeah, I know, and a cheesy mustache. Good 70s America mustache.
You should have a mustache. I think you should grow one.
No, it's a bad look for me. Trust me.
I don't know. I think it'd work out really good for us.
Our special guest this week, a fellow Chicagoan, which continues to illustrate the wealth of comic book talent that is here in our home city. You probably know him from drawing such titles as JSA, Detective Comics, Batman, and the soon to be completed JSA versus Cobra. He is Mr. Don Kramer.
How you doing, Chris?
Good, Don. Thank you for making the trek up here. I say yes.
Applause, everyone.
I say that you're a fellow Chicagoan, but you're actually a far south suburbs.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is Bourbonnais still considered Chicagoland?
Sometimes.
So yeah, exactly.
It's easier to explain than just say Chicago when you're talking to somebody out of state.
All right.
Where the hell's Bourbonnais? Sounds like a sauce.
Exactly.
That's where the Bears training camp is for all the football fans out there, all five of you listening to the show. So.
Yeah, it's in my backyard practically.
Yeah. You say the town changes a little bit during training camp.
Yes, it does.
Training cramp.
During training cramp.
Well, before we jump in here, I want to make sure everyone knows this episode of Around Comics is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. And if you are a trade waiter or if you just prefer to read some of your comics in collected editions, InStockTrades.com should be your first stop on the internet. They've got all of your collected edition needs, from trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, omnibus editions, absolute editions, and more. Basically, if it is collected, it is at InStockTrades.com at a great discounted rate. And remember that all orders over $50 do in fact ship for free. And right now you can pick up our book club selection, which is Hellblazer, Dangerous Habits. It is discounted an amazing 47% off the cover price. So, I mean, there's no reason not to at least try this out, because it's only $7.94.
Who wrote Dangerous Habits? I forget who wrote that one.
Garth Ennis.
That was Garth Ennis.
Okay. We talked about whenever we did our JLA Avengers episode, that is the one that really pulled a lot of the stuff from, or they pulled a lot from
for
that
the movie.
For the movie.
Yes.
It's one of the best stories from Hellblazer 2. It's phenomenal.
It is. Yeah. I'm looking forward to hearing a couple weeks. Tom, have you jumped into it yet?
Yeah. I'm saving it until closer so I remember.
Okay.
If I read it right away, I forget by the time we get, and then I just got to make shit up.
Yeah.
And it was just so many great writers have written Hellblazer over the years and stuff. I think Milligan actually even doing a good job currently.
Milligan, Delano, Azzurillo.
What issue number are they on? They're like on 230.
They just passed 250.
I mean, in the last few months. That's pretty amazing. So. It's 250 issues
over
of Hellblazer.
20 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was one of the first Vertigo books, and yeah, it is, I think, the longest running continuous series of Vertigo.
It's an Alan Moore character.
Are they all in trade?
I say it was running before there was officially a Vertigo.
That's true, too. Yes, you're right about that.
Yeah, just like Swamp Thing. Last order of business, all the music from our in this episode is from one of my favorite bands.
Death Cab for Cutie?
No, not Death Cab for Cutie, even though I do like the Death
Cab. The Boo Radleys?
No.
That's
Tom. Now you're in Tom.
I like the Boo Radleys.
Like Martin Carr. Martin Carr.
This is Grant Lee Buffalo. One of my
fantastic!
I love Grant Lee Buffalo. Hilarious. And the front man Grant Lee Phillips. I'm sure we'll pop up as a featured artist at some point. He has a new solo record that's very good.
You need an internet radio station, and it really needs to be like Chris's Juke Joint. And that really is just like
Chris's time machine.
I do the same. I mean, I live in the past as well. But I'm just saying,
if you listen to XM or Sirius or whatever it is,
which channel?
Deep Tracks.
Okay.
Tom Petty does a great show called Buried Treasure. It's so good.
Oh, I bet that's cool.
It's really good.
I just found a great new live music television show on Ovation, and I know it's on Comcast. I don't know if every satellite and cable provider has Ovation, but they always, first of all, they rerun all the later with Jules Holland BBC shows, and that's an amazing live music show. But this was called Spotlight On, and it was individual acoustic artists, playing a couple tracks, and then they move on to somebody else, and they ran through like six acts in an hour, and it was great. And it kind of felt like, in the same way, if you ever watch on Sundance, Live from Abbey Road.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And that's the thing. I just love shows like that, where it really is not only, just bare bones, just the instrument and the artist, performing, but also that, you're not getting the hit the way that, it was produced for the album. It really is a unique performance and stuff. I
appreciate that stuff a lot more, too. Man. I mean, I just at that concert.
Yeah, speaking of music, we had Christian Alame on a couple weeks ago, and I contacted Don to see if he wanted to come up and sit in while we had Christian here.
He refused.
And he said, no. He said, who are you again?
Who is this guy?
and then he told me he was going to the Mike Doty concert. Cool. Where was it at again? Because he was at Shuba's on Thursday night, but
he was at the Lincoln Hall. It was the very first live show that they had at the new Lincoln
Hall. Oh yeah,
that's
right, so, Lincoln Hall. Yeah. I was at Shuba's on Tuesday this week.
I love Shuba's.
So, I've never been to Shuba's yet.
Shuba's is awesome.
I'd love to see
that. It still is like an XRT staple.
Shuba's, and anyone listening has no idea what I'm describing here, but Shuba's is about the size of this comic shop.
Oh, I know. It's very, very small.
Small.
Venue.
Yeah. And flat great floor. So, short people to the front, hopefully.
and Booze fans will appreciate, and I mean Booze, yes, the fact that it was one of those original Schlitz taverns where they actually brewed beer on the top floor. Mm-hmm. And it still has the old Schlitz globe up on the front. And it really is this like old, I don't know how far back the bar goes. It has to go back at least to the 20s or 30s.
Yeah.
And likely maybe.
And the Harmony Grill there is a really good restaurant.
Awesome food.
So there's
How much are we getting paid by Shuba's?
Well, just, when you're traveling in Chicago and you're done with your comic shopping, a cool place to hang out, Shuba's.
Nico Case was the house band there for a long time. Yep. She performed like every Thursday or something.
Beer's a little pricey if you're just hanging out.
Belmont.
Sneak Southport.
A flask in. Belmont Southport. Belmont, exactly.
Do what Tom does. Well, sneak hard liquor in.
Well, Don, thank you for coming up and visiting with us. You have no idea, but you're one of the only, maybe the only comic book artist that my wife actually knows that you exist.
Oh, really?
And that
she thinks it was made by machines before.
Machines and Don Kramer.
But that is because my wife is an Illinois Wesleyan grad.
Oh, okay.
So you guys.
That's right. I remember now. The first time I had talked to you, you told me about that.
Yeah.
Are you an honored alum?
Yes, Don? I am.
That's cool. That's really cool. What year did you graduate?
Dating myself quite a bit, but 91. Yeah.
Okay. Because Bradstreet and I were at Illinois State. Mm-hmm. Just down the street, just a few years before you.
If I remember right, I think Bradstreet was working the comic shop there when I... When I first moved down there, I walked into Metropolis Comics, and if I remember right, he was behind the desk at the counter at the time. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing to see that because you're seeing like some of his first vampires works that he was doing.
Absolutely.
And this is very, I didn't realize it was him at the time. You know?
Have you talked to him since about it, like in San Diego?
Yeah, you know, I've talked to him a few times about
and
it.
Mentioned,
you know,
the fact that obviously you were Wesleyan dude and everything in the neighborhood?
Yeah, well, the interesting
thing. Did he remember
he didn't remember me then, but about that. But we got to talking about our local haunts when we go out around there, though. And the really cool thing is you actually see some of the people around town that he'd use as models. You know,
oh, that's cool.
So I do remember seeing
you. Put in these things.
You've been on a Punisher cover.
Put in these fangs.
Wolverine does look like he comes from Central Illinois. I think that does make sense.
He does. Yeah, he does have a very unique Central Illinois flavor to him.
Back when he was doing the vampire stuff.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Now the White Wolf. Yeah. The role playing game. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forget what was it. White Wolf. I forget what publisher it was.
I think it was White Wolf.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
that was cool.
Yeah, there was a games publishing company down in Bloomington. I think that's where he started.
Yes. You know, yeah, downtown Normal, like right by in the shadow of the Illinois State campus.
Yeah, there was this right next to it. Yeah,
gaming company.
There's this main drag where there's, you know, just all where all the college kids would hang out,
the bars and the theaters,
and right in between all the art supply stores, the bars, the head shops.
Yes, true.
That are there. Pick up my bongs and my comics.
Yeah. Well, this will freak you out. You can drink on the campus of Illinois Wesleyan now. They, as a matter of fact, have a bar in the student center.
Oh my God. I know. We got
that's how a civilized hell, man.
We got busted so many times
as a University of Wisconsin graduate. That is how a civilized university you have a bar in the student union. Yeah, in the student union. That's nice. The civilized way.
So just as these brain cells were just getting fired up by knowledge and stuff, yeah, come on down to the bar, we'll kill them for you.
Yeah, in the student center.
That's where all great philosophy happened.
When my wife and a bunch of my friends that she went to school with went there, it was a dry campus, and that was kind of, you know, the game is seeing, you know, how far you could push it and hide the booze wherever. And
oh yeah, we pushed it pretty far when I was.
Well, you know, that brings up kind of the first question I wanted to ask you is, you know, we've talked to a lot of artists on the show and a lot of the Chicago area creators, and it seems like there are so many different paths into the industry from an education standpoint. It's like Jenny Frizen, who's a local gal, went to the Kubert School. Mike Norton went to Memphis State. Scotty Young, I think, is self-taught. I don't even think that he went to art school. But you chose a small liberal arts school. Whenever you decided to go to Wesleyan, did you already have it in your mind that you wanted to be a comic book artist?
I think it was always in the back of my mind. I mean, ever since I was, I'm guessing, around 13 or 14, when I realized that people made a living doing this. And that was something that I decided I really wanted to make a try for. And yeah, that was in the back of my mind as I was working. Everything when I was in, you know, at Wesleyan, going to art school there, everything I did was a little more geared towards sequential art. You know, even the paintings that I had done, I'd do like a set of five or six paintings, and over the course of those, they told like a short story, you know.
Yeah, that's cool.
Very cool.
And things like that I would do. And so, yeah, I mean, all along I was heavily influenced by comics.
Now, were you there as a commercial artist or a fine artist, or was there much differentiation between the programs at that point?
Mainly I guess I was there more as a fine artist because they introduced me to painting and all of that, which I really did enjoy doing. But I at that time, I didn't see the avenue of painting as an opportunity to get into comics. And by the time I was already drawing and everything, then you see Alex Ross show up and
yeah, like, jerk.
But then you see somebody like him, and it's like, oh, God, throw away the paintbrushes. Yeah.
I cannot do that. If that's what painting for comics is, I cannot do that. Yeah.
Well, you know, obviously developed your own style. We were talking about it before you came into the shop. That, I mean, you are a very, very skilled draftsman, but you're one of the people that whenever someone talks about storytelling, you Mike Norton are two guys that come top of mind. Is like, these guys understand the medium. They know how to tell a story and really bring the reader along. And
no, thank you.
Is that just something innate just from reading comics, or is that something that you've really had to work on over the years, or did it come easy to you?
You know, it's something that became a little innate as I was reading comics growing up. And then as I got older and started to, you know, treat this as my craft, I started studying, you know, kind of what actually worked. And there's a lot of really bad pages out there that I've done before I, you know, before I started to learn how to do things properly, you know.
So from college to, was Caliber the first publisher that was printing your stuff, or was there a step in between?
Oh, you're Caliber alum?
I did a few issues for Caliber, yes. Wow. And there was a number of different, like, fly-by-night comic companies that
he's not going to tell us any of what they're
sure. People well, probably have them in their quarterbacks and they'll realize.
He doesn't want us to find out about the bad pages. Hey, you know,
everybody's got an issue of Flaxen or something like that negative burn and things like that.
Yeah, you know, Chris Somni in that one issue of Big Bang Comics that that he doesn't like us to mention.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh, yeah.
And we found it.
That's what I always abuse Bendis and Mac about and stuff is Flaxen over at Caliber. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the very first thing I'd ever done was, you know, I met a friend of mine, Greg Scopus, and he was putting together his comic book, and that was the very first comic book I did. It was just completely self-published, you know. I just needed something, a good script, you know, something for me to focus on as I was drawing, and it gave me, you know, the discipline to sit down and draw every night since I had this script, and that was the very first. And yeah, there's a number of them I don't really care to talk about, but I did a book for Thorby with it was like Thorby Comics Fly by Night.
I don't remember Thorby. How about now? Was now in your past?
No, okay. That was a Chicago company.
Now first.
Any first work?
Nope. I wish because I loved Grimjack.
Didn't it drive you nuts? Because you're only a few years younger than me, but yeah, it was just like. This cool little comic book company was in Evanston, mm-hmm. and great, you know, Ostrander was there, Tim Truman was there, Grell was there.
A ton of the Chicago alumni, Azzarillo and Tony Aiken,
Paul Mounts.
It's just all those guys worked for First and what was the other?
Kimiko? It was now First and Kimiko.
Was
I guess.
Kimiko Chicago?
I think it was, wasn't
it?
Yeah. I know that's
Joe Gentile and Azzarello. I know worked for Kimiko for a while.
So. They had those little offshoots. Was it like North Star and all those other little companies that they had that were there?
There was some cool stuff that came out of there.
You know, early 90s comics, you know, in Chicago, there was a lot of really good small indie publishers around here.
Yep.
I have a lot of them in my
head. Nexus, Elementals, mm-hmm. The Justice Machine.
Justice Machine, I remember that. Absolutely.
I looked at that the other day. I'm redoing my comic room, and it's like, oh, cool.
If you remember First, they had John Sable and
Badger. Mike Grell. The Badger, Mike Baron, absolutely.
Nexus was there too.
Steve Rude, sure.
Well, that started. Where did Nexus start?
Capital City and Madison, and then Capital City shut down, and First. Picked it up.
Yeah. Now, is that part of the reason that you ended up in Chicago, or are you a Chicagoan born and bred?
I was raised all my life here. I live in Bourbonnais right now, and it's because my family is there, and I'm comfortable, you know, there with my, you know, my kids, my grandparents.
I thought you were just a huge Bears fan.
And I am a huge Bears fan, yes.
I have to be there.
I have to be at training camp.
Yeah, camp out for training camp.
Yeah.
I'm always the first one.
But if that was the case, I would have been over in Platteville. For
me. Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's right. You're always true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No one wants to be in Platteville.
The first work that I became familiar with was JSA. Was that the first real mainstream work that you were doing, or had you been working on some other stuff before that?
Well, officially, the very first work that I did was a Thing story I did for Marvel.
Oh.
And it was just a one-shot Startling Stories, I think it was called, The Thing.
Who wrote that?
Ron Zimmerman.
Okay, interesting.
Remember when Ron was doing a lot of books for Marvel?
The Howard Stern writer.
Yes, yeah. He was a great guy. You know,
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I met him out in California, and just a fantastically good guy.
He's a 500 writer. He wrote a lot of really good books, and he wrote a lot of bad books. And was, you know, much like Chuck Austin, kind of, you know, I think the villagers came out with the torches and kind of drove them out of
comic
the
comic fans yeah. don't do you that.
Know? No, they're so sweet and understanding. Absolutely.
He was, to me though, I mean, when I read a lot of his stories, I mean, he's like the home run hitter that would strike out, you know, quite often.
Yeah, he was Dave Kingman.
Yeah.
That's Dave Kingman, yeah.
But when he told a good story,
Dave Kingman never hit 500.
I completely agree, man. Yeah. No, he had some really good stories. I quite agree. I loved his Rawhide Kid.
I never read that, though.
It was funny.
Yeah, I never
and
did read
beautiful
that.
Beautiful John Severin art, it was funny. And everyone got their, you know, undies all in a knot over it and everything. And it was like, hey, calm down. It's actually funny.
Yeah, well, that was more or less his forte, was the humor in things. And a lot of fans didn't appreciate some of the humor, I guess, you know.
The thing is, someone that I wouldn't normally, you know, think of because of your realistic style, that's interesting to kind of have you draw somebody like the thing.
It was different. What had happened was Axel Alonso was the first editor that was willing to give me some work. And
was this before he went to Rolling Stone?
it was right before he left DC is what happened. He was getting set to give me some work at DC.
Oh, okay.
And then he jumped ship over to Marvel, and he called me up and said, you know, don't worry, I'm still keeping you in mind, because I had yet to work for any major company yet. And then he had lined that up. And in the meantime, just as I was finishing up the Thing story, another friend of mine, Chris Golden, I had met Chris and Tom out in San Diego, and they were the ones that really gave me the boost, you know, as far as introducing me to editors and all of that. Ironically enough, I was at a table at ChicagoCon, and I was showing them my sample portfolios, and it was Chris Golden, Tom Snegoski, and John Cassaday.
Wow.
And it was, I felt really, I mean, just, I was head over heels at the time, because I was so excited, because all three of them just really liked my portfolio, and they started taking me around to their editors, and
that's cool.
And yeah, from there it started to lead to more work. And I can't thank those guys enough. You know, I mean, everything that they had done is kind of, you know, helpful to where I am today. And yeah, I mean, what happened was, though, after I had finished the Thing story, Chris Golden had gotten a Dr. Fate miniseries. And the Dr. Fate miniseries, he had asked Pete Tomasi, who was then the editor, to bring me on board. And, you know, no one had ever heard of me. So I got a call from Pete Tomasi saying, well, let's see your samples. And I sent them over, and he said, "Okay, you're hired. You know, let's go to work."
Who was under the Fate helmet back then?
It was Hector Hall.
Okay,
okay.
And Chris was he was essentially like trying to tell his version of the Dr. Fate movie. You know, if he was to do a movie of Dr. Fate, this would be it right here. And,
that's cool.
And trying to keep it with, you know, within what had already happened within the DC universe.
Did you like drawing Dr. Fate?
You know, started off, I was having a rough time drawing everything on a full-time basis.
Yeah.
Because that was my very first job where I sat down, and I sat there for the, you know, 10, 12 hours a day just sitting there drawing. And, you know, when I first started out, you know, you'd go to bed at night and my forearm is sore, you know.
Had to build up the muscles.
Yeah. Carpal tunnel, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it was a little bit of time, you know, and a lot of mistakes. And I
are those some of the bad pages you were talking about?
I feel that way about everything that I do, kind of.
Yeah,
most artists.
Yeah, the artist remorse that only the artist sees.
Yeah, you really hate to let go of pages sometimes, but due to deadlines and just natural mistakes as an artist, you do that, though. But no, for the most part, I was pretty happy with what was going on at Dr. Fate. You know, I mean, I've learned a little bit more since then, but so it's not my favorite work now. But I think I did the best I could at the time.
Sure, it had been that bad. And you kept getting worse.
Yeah, I know. It was very good. You know, it was very good for me. And yeah, I mean, Chris was great about it. He put up with all my mistakes and everything, and yeah, we put together a nice little miniseries at the time. So nice.
We had an opportunity to draw a lot more of Dr. Fate because you would you go on to work on JSA with Jeff Johns. Now, whenever you came into the series, Jeff was the solo writer. He had since stopped co-writing with Goyer at that point, right?
Yeah, the first book we put out was the first book that he took over the solo. You know,
what story arc was that?
It was the aftermath of Princes of Darkness, and it was a little two-part story that involved the Crimson Avenger hunting down Wildcat Girl.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, that was the very very first thing, and it was Jeff's very first completely solo as a writer. Officially on as the writer for JSA, you know, before he was working with Goyer and I don't know
James
how that,
Robinson too.
Yeah, it was James Robinson and David Goyer, and then I think it was Goyer and Johns, and then just Johns.
That's
and,
right. James left pretty early. That's yeah, right. I always yeah, forget he, that. Like inside yeah, like the first few issues.
It's like it almost spun out of Starman.
Yes.
And then Robinson was on for not that long, and then it was the Goyer and Johns. But Johnson. And you can really tell the tone of that book changed whenever it was just Jeff Johns. That he had an obvious an obvious vision for what those characters, you know, who they were and what he wanted to do with it. What was your relationship with him as an artist? I always love hearing about the writer-artist collaborative effort. Was he the kind of guy that was very open to ideas?
Couldn't be better. It was the best artist-writer relationship I think I've ever had. You know, he would always call me up and we'd talk about the stories long before I think he even started writing them. And he had plans for this and that and you know, he'd, what do you think? You know, and sometimes I'd throw in ideas that I had and he'd be, you know, no, I got it covered, you know. But then there are other times where he said, yeah, that'll work, you know. And he was just very, you know, just very good working with all of his artists from what I'm aware. You know, he really makes it a collaborative process, and I think that's part of why he's so successful as a writer. He gets it as a writer as well as how to work as a team, you know, with everybody and keep everybody involved, interested, and really appreciating what they're doing.
You know? Did you and Leonard Kirk, did you guys alternate on arcs, or would you guys work within the same arc sometimes? How did that work out?
It happened a few different times just because of my speed, you know, and Leonard is an amazingly good artist that's very fast. And when I started the book, there were times where the deadlines were getting tight, and I guess Leonard was available, and they started working and
worked well together.
I think that Pete saw something in our works that there was some similarity, you know, so we could work off of each other without too much of a jarring.
Absolutely.
He did some phenomenal work, you know, and it was tough to, in those early days especially, it was tough to, you know, keep up with, you know, all the good artists that were around as well. And I was still learning the process and still, you know, trying to, you know, just become a better artist at the
time. Was the sheer number of characters intimidating?
Oh, God, yes.
I've seen some double-page spreads that have, like, everyone. It's like, holy crap. Yeah,
there's a reason why it's called Justice Society. Yeah.
JSA and my guess is Legion are probably two of the hardest books to draw. I mean, just because of the sheer volume of characters, you know. Because it really does take a little bit of time of drawing a character, you know, a few times before you actually get comfortable enough.
Team books are tough.
Yeah, where you're not actually having to reference, you know, the costume. You forget about just the little minute details of a costume, and you're constantly having to reference those costumes, you know.
Did you find a surprise character that you really became vested in? You know, talk about the collaborative effort. Were the characters that you ended up really falling in love with that kind of surprised you on the book?
You know, Jeff, the way he wrote things and we would talk about stories, he made me really appreciate all of them. You know, I mean, it could be this one particular issue. Oh, I really love Mr. Terrific, you know, and another issue. Oh, man, I love Dour Man, you know, and I have to say that actually, I got to say Terrific was one I was surprised that I how much I enjoyed him.
Did you ever forget to put the fair play on the sleeve? Is that one of the details? Is that one of the details? Oh, yeah. No, I forgot fair play on the sleeve.
Yeah, got to have fair play.
I'm glad you mentioned Dour Man because the story with Rick Tyler and Rex the father and son in particular.
Our Man has always been one of my favorites when it comes to the JSA, and it's not just his powers or anything like that. It's that whole father son relationship that really it strikes a lot of people, I'm sure, and I mean, it hits home with me. You know, I mean, my father was always gone when he was working. When I was growing up, he was a truck driver, and okay. I'd see him maybe, you know, once a week, you know, and so to see that and watch that play out in the story, it hit home as I was drawing it. It was like, this is the stuff that I really loved, was the emotion in a story. And that's actually what really drives me, is, you know, as far as what really gets me going in a story are the emotional beats. And it really like thrills me when I get a chance to draw those. So
from a visual standpoint too, I think the Golden Age Our Man in particular, one of the simplest costumes of the Golden Age, but it's just so classically cool. I mean, just that very simple cowl and the hourglass, you know, for the pendant around his neck, and just the simple black and gold color scheme.
He's a great character. You know? I like his costume. I prefer his costume over Rick's.
Me too, man.
So, which costume was the trickiest to get a hold of?
Dr. Fate was a little bit tough at the time. Hawkman.
That's a lot of feathers, man.
The feathers are a pain.
Pain in the ass, y'all. Yeah.
Fucking feathers.
I was amazed at how quickly Ivan Reis really got those feathers down just phenomenally well.
He's so good.
Can we have more scenes where Hawkman doesn't have the wings on?
Can you take them off every
time? Do we have to have Hawkman and Hawkgirl in the same thing?
More Thanagarians.
Yeah, I'm thinking a Thanagarian invasion. Oh, you're killing me. Well, you had a nice, healthy run on that series. You were on how long were you on JSA?
Roughly, I think 2.5 years.
Okay.
Like that, maybe three.
Do you like doing that? Do you like being on a book for a nice long time, or do you like maybe getting in for 6 issues and then out? Or
I prefer to be on a book like regularly, you know, but it really depends on, you know, who I'm working with and the characters and everything. But I've really enjoyed, you know, I really did enjoy the time I was working on JSA. It was fun.
That was a book that I think JSA, you know, from the relaunch, it really developed, you know, this great sense of family, and readers kind of came on and really became vested in the characters. And then, you know, it started doing some really pretty interesting things and kind of redefining, you know, family and heroes and all of that. And then we have the Black Adam character, which was really the first arc that I came into as a fan of the series. I had a shop owner before Mark here at Dark Tower actually. So, oh man, you need to read this Black Rain series. And that one of my favorites, because it really turned Black Adam into a sympathetic, but
yeah, you understood his motivation.
He's a sympathetic villain.
I mean, he does have good reasons for doing what he does at times. You know,
he's the Namor of the DC universe. You totally understand why he's pissed, and you feel for him. And this is well before 52 and ISIS and things. And I really liked the bond that he grew to have with Billy and Captain Marvel.
Oh yeah,
and you know, really Captain Marvel going from absolutely like, you know, still like, hey, I know this guy, we can't trust him, to, you know, Adam really reaching out to Billy and saying, you know, hey, man, you're a brother to me, when they went back to ancient Egypt and the JSA was there with Dr. Fate and Hawkman and
J. Garrick. That was great.
It was well, yeah, that too. I mean, it's just and Black Rain in particular, I think, and especially the timeliness of Black Rain and Kandak, and having that kind of Iraq comparison and everything.
Yeah, actually, it had come out right about the time that the Iraq War was starting, though, this was something that he had planned for a while, but there was also, you know, obviously things going on in the world that were kind of leading to the
serendipity.
Sure.
But there was really no clear right or wrong, you know, in that story. And that's what made it so good. You know, everybody had good reasons for doing what they did. And you could pick a side very easily and not be wrong, you know.
And suddenly he has this, you know, Black Adam has this country that really does look to him as a protector. And that sense of honor and duty that he suddenly felt and was able to, you know, I mean, still had his own self-motivations of the way he acted, but also did it on behalf of his people and really became this protector of his people. I thought was really cool.
He was kind of like the exiled king that had come back in that particular storyline,
yep.
You know, and he was there to take back the country for his people, you know, and there are, you know, he had some very good motivations, you know.
I always like Black Adam visually because he looks intimidating. He's even though he's not had the, yeah, like there's always when he's drawn properly, there's like an intimidation to him, even though he, you know, he doesn't have any of the sort of decorations that he doesn't have like a giant mask, or he doesn't have, you know, like anything that would be really horrific, but it's always very intimidating, you know?
Very very commanding, yeah, you know, yeah.
It's self-assured too, mm-hmm. I mean that's the thing, it was always like, you know, I could like snap you in two in a second if I wanted to.
Yeah, well, he's essentially kind of Superman with the Punisher sensibilities, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a very tough guy for the, I mean, when it comes to the DC universe, I he's kind of an enigma, because at times he can be the good guy, and at other times he is definitely the bad guy. You know?
And he became a good foil for Atom Smasher as well, and suddenly Nuklon for years in Infinity Inc. and everything with the Mohawk.
Yeah.
You know, I was really happy that they changed his costume and gave him a more classic Atom look to him and everything, yeah. But I really thought that their interplay as well. I thought there were some very dramatic moments that, you know, you guys were able to play out.
I always thought of Black Adam as kind of like Captain Marvel grown up, like in the real world where like bad things happen, you know,
but
the weird reversal, because Captain Marvel, you know, Billy Batson did have all kinds of terrible things, like his parents died, he sort of, his character sort of comes from a like everything, a happier place.
Yeah.
But
Fawcett,
you know,
City,
but
you know.
Black Adam sort of like
a world where you could go down into a subway and follow a creepy old man,
and nothing bad will happen.
What's the problem? End up okay.
Yeah, nothing bad, and he'll show you the seven sins, and nothing evil will happen. But Black Adam is more of like the sort of real, more not real world, but like if. What happens when you have all the bad stuff sort of pile up on you in your life, you know, and how you...
People would eventually snap, you know.
You resent, you know, with all the resentment. And
there's a different sense of justice.
Every time, like, anything good happens to you, like, it seems something bad then happens to, like, take it away from you. You can't, you know, escape from...
Did you have a really rough life?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also the
going apple picking tomorrow, but
the elevation of his character too, I think, finally put the Marvel family in more into the DC universe than it ever had been successfully done before. Because there were some pockets of good runs that didn't just go for the simple, happy C.C. Beck style of Shazam stories. I think Don Newton with World's Finest, I think, had some you know, there was an attempt to kind of make Marvel a little bit less goofy and funny and a little bit more traditionally superhero. But with, you know, Black Adam, suddenly you had this serious counterweight that had to be dealt with. And, you know, Talkie Tawny wasn't going to be able to come by and do something goofy to work their way out of a problem anymore. You know?
I'm willing to allow Talkie Tawny to have it shot.
I was going to say, have you seen what Talkie Tawny can do with a machine gun and a jetpack?
Oh, hey, man. Yeah, I think I mean, that's the thing now. And now all of a sudden, Talkie Tawny could be right there with Commandy's lion face people and stuff like that. It fit very well.
Talkie Tawny's still insane. It's still a crazy...
Oh yeah,
like a tiger in like a foppish suit.
Billy.
Just wandering.
How are you?
Like,
do you enjoy my plan?
Have you ever had a chance to draw Talkie Tawny?
No.
Do you want to draw Talkie Tawny?
You know, probably not. I'm not a big fan of Talkie Tawny. Yeah.
What do you mean? Whenever you sit down, and you read a script. What makes you go, oh fuck yeah?
You know, the emotional beats of a story. You know that. The ones that make you, you know, that'll piss you off or make you cry, you know, those are the beats that really grab me in a story. And it's not the fight scenes, because once you've drawn a fight scene, you start, you know, it's a similar fight scene, you know.
I mean, choreography of it.
Yes.
It's almost putting together a dance routine. You know, one of my all-time favorite comic book issues, and I know that sounds like a lot of hyperbole, but yeah, I've been saying this for – it's a lot of hyperbole. We're going to switch gears from JSA.
Before you do, I want – because you
– We can always come back.
Because I want to say real fast, you've got a Black Adam connection coming up in a new story, correct?
Yeah. I guess the next book I'm going to be doing is a Blackest Night tie-in, Power of Shazam.
All right. I saw that Dan introduced that it was coming back. A lot of dead books. We're going to put dead people in dead books. I think that'll be fun. Power of Shazam, dead book.
Exactly.
So who's writing this?
Eric Wallace, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he just did Ink, Final Crisis.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I just got the script you know, a few hours before I came up here.
Oh, cool, man. Wow.
So, I mean, and not even all of it, just a little portion of it, though. So I really haven't had a chance to read too much into it. And I couldn't tell you what was going to happen anyway. But
I understand.
But I know it involves Osiris.
And, of course. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
The bad Captain Marvel Jr., if you will. The bad Black Adam Jr.
With the crocodile.
The crocodile scene in 52 was just not pleasant. Yeah. I was just like, oh, man, that had to hurt.
So that's cool.
Yeah, so he's nice. Coming back, you know, in this issue. So
it's going to have some crocodile marks on him?
Perhaps. He's a zombie, after all. So.
Yeah.
Chris, favorite issue of all time?
Yes, I'm sorry.
You were just talking about your favorite
issue. One of my favorite issues of all time was the Detective Comics issue that you did with Paul Denny, the Joker-Robin car ride.
Oh, yeah. I really loved doing that book. That was that particular issue. I got it in my inbox and my email. And
is that one of those scripts that you're talking about?
Where I got giddy.
There's a little emotion in that one.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was giddy when I got that script. As a matter of fact, I called up immediately called up Wayne Foucher, my inker at the time, and I read him the script over the phone. I was like, and then this happens. Whoops. And then this happens. And then this happens. And he's like, oh, that's gonna be cool.
You're gonna have fun with that. You kicked that book's ass. Was a beautiful book.
I had a lot of fun with that one. I did enjoy that quite a bit, though. Yeah. That was actually that was actually the very first script that Paul Dini had written for Detective.
Okay.
And they decided to hold it, of course, for Christmas, though. But that was the very first one that, you know, that he started working
on. That's the one that was kind of percolating in his head for a while. I mean, it could have been a really twisted episode of Batman, the animated series. I could have seen that of being just a great episode in that. But, you know, in the comic book, you're able to, you know, maybe even go a little bit darker than what you could have for a kid's
cartoon. An all-ages cartoon, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. That was definitely his intention, to be able to tell some of the stories that he couldn't tell on the Batman animated,
You know, you talked about working with Geoff Johns. What was it like to work with Paul Denny?
You know, I had very little contact with Paul, unfortunately. With, like Geoff, we were talking maybe once, twice a week, you know, at least, you know, and sometimes a lot more than that. But with Paul, I had through emails, we had contact with each other a few times, but I didn't get a chance to meet him actually until I was pretty much off the run, you know. And
I thought that was set up to be such a great thing with Detective, that it was going to be, you know, one shot issues, and it was you know, Paul Denny and Don Kramer. It's like, oh man, these are going to be awesome. And it seems like they just kind of bailed out of it sooner than I wanted them to. And I don't know if that was, you know, because Grant Morrison was coming on and doing his stuff with the Batverse. And
well, they were also doing the tie-ins. I mean, they were doing the Ra's al Ghul storyline.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Those other things that were
those damn fifth week events, man. And I honestly, I some of those stories just weren't worth getting away from each individual book. I'm saying this as a reader, man. I'm telling you, like, to have to suddenly, you know, detour into this event that, you know.
Sometimes I'm in agreement with you.
I'm saying it. It's okay, though. Yeah.
Well, you know, go ahead.
But the only thing I was going to say is you kind of came into that Detective run because, was it Rags and J.H. Williams? Weren't they initially announced? And then, because, I mean, I know you came, like, literally it was, you know, it's kind of like going to your bench when all of a sudden, you know, okay, J.H. Williams is going to do it. And then suddenly he was out. And then all of a sudden it was Don got the job. And it was great because, hey, man, Don can get to the plate and hit it out of the park. And you did.
Well, thank you.
But honestly, what was the sequence of events?
That's kind of what happened, though. I mean, everybody was busy with different books at the time. And I was actually scheduled to go on 52.
That's right, yeah.
And then I had gotten a call. Actually, I had literally gotten the first script for 52. It just came in the mail, and I was reading that just ready to get started on the very first book, and I got a call from Pete, my editor at the time, and said, "Well, you're not going to do that anymore. we're gonna put you on this." And I was like, "Okay."
That's cool. Detective Comics is a nice consolation prize.
Oh, I had no complaints. I enjoy drawing Batman.
Yeah. Better than being punished with 52.
I would tell you there would be a lot of need for reference if I was to be doing that. I'd be calling her up constantly. I need reference for this, and I need reference for that. So yeah, it was a lot easier, I have to admit, drawing Batman at the time. So.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we left JSA for a little while, but just like you did, we're going to come back to it in the form of JSA Cobra, and we're going to talk to your collaborator on the series, Mr. Eric Troutman. So, let us call Mr. Troutman. This portion of Around Comics is brought to you by Netflix. Right now, you can start a free 2-week trial by going to www.netflix.com/aroundcomics. At Netflix, you'll find over 100,000 titles to choose from, including classics and new releases, as well as TV series. Plans start from as low as $4.99 per month, and you can keep each movie as long as you want with no late fees ever. Netflix has free shipping both ways, and you can expect your next selection to be delivered in about one business day. Now watch some movies and TV series over the internet for no extra charge. I use this service with my Xbox 360 and personal laptop and love it. So head over to www.netflix.com/aroundcomics and get started with your free trial today. And we are joined on the phone by Mr. Eric Troutman. Eric, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you guys tonight?
Doing just fine. It's trying to figure out if we're going to have to take a boat home because it's been raining for like the entire last month. But you're from the Pacific Northwest, so you're used to that.
Rain. I think I've heard of that.
Sure. before we get started here, you know, I just have to ask, how's Greg?
How's Greg? you know, it's funny. I haven't talked to him for a couple of weeks. He was off.
Oh shit! Someone check Chris's house. that's a reason.
Are we sure Greg Ruck is okay? Anyone heard from him within the last couple weeks?
I've seen him on Twitter. I've definitely seen tweets on Twitter.
I wouldn't put it over Chris to figure out how to log in as him.
That's a good point.
He's read Greg's books. He knows how to leave a smoke screen.
Well, you know, Eric, you're my secondary stalkee, so it's you're right behind Greg, and you're gaining.
Yeah, well, I understand and accept your condition.
And his lawyer is listening in on the phone conversation, so don't worry, everything's fine.
Well, I tell you what, since we have your fantastic artist riding along with us here, why don't we jump in and talk about JSA Cobra, which has been a fantastic series. I believe that the first 5 of 6 issues have been released, and we're eagerly awaiting the conclusion. What I love more than anything is that this is really what I feel as a continuation of Checkmate, which you were obviously really involved with as a co-writer with Greg. And is that really how this project came about, as you having such a grasp on the current Checkmate series, and was that the lead in to JSA Cobra for you?
Yes and no. I'm a little fuzzy on what the actual genesis of the project was. Checkmate had wrapped, and I had done Final Crisis Resist and done some graphic design work for Greg on his Question miniseries. But, you know, I kind of said goodbye to Checkmate pretty much. Final Crisis Resist, to my mind, is sort of the Checkmate finale, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten a call from the editor, Rachel Gluckstern, asking me if I was interested in writing a Cobra series. I presume because they knew I had some notions of stuff to do with Cobra and Checkmate that we never got to implement. And, I jumped at the chance because, you know, the history of the character, you know, having his own book, having guys like Marty Pasco and Jack Kirby and all these cool creators associated with it. It's like, you know, I'd love to write a series from the villain's perspective. I had been asked to, you know, submit some proposals, and I pitched, and at one point, the series was actually structured similarly to Greg's five books, Greg Rucka's Question series, Five Books of Blood, where I was going to have Cobra operating in different cities around the world and thus encountering different super teams. And it was at that point that apparently it had been decided that, as they were looking at the proposals, hey, wouldn't it make sense to focus on one super team? And it was decided it would be the JSA. And it was amusing to me how it was communicated to me, because Rachel's initial note was, these are really good, but I'm a little curious why you're not focusing on the JSA. And I said, I'm a little curious why you think I should. Well, internally, we call the book JSA versus Cobra. Oh, but I'm external, you see.
See, I'm not in on those meetings.
I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time. You know,
sure. Stop writing all these Z-Crew.
So once it became clear it was a JSA book, I kind of went back, and a lot of the stuff that I had developed for Checkmate-related purposes, I just threw away, because in the interim, Faces of Evil had Cobra had come out. Mm-hmm. So it was a completely different organization. So I'm a little amused by the kind of standard line that I hear a lot about how it's like a continuation of Checkmate. Cause like everything I had planned gone, absolutely gone. I approached it very differently than I would have approached the Checkmate project. Clearly the paramilitary tone and the contemporary counterterrorism stuff is very similar to a lot of what Checkmate was about, but in terms of how I actually sat down to write the scripts, it was a very different process for me. Does that answer your question
in a
very long-winded, boring way?
No. That's pretty. You know, it's with the JSA, and it's not Checkmate, but you have a couple of the key figures in Alan Scott and Mr. Terrific, and you would obviously explore those characters in Checkmate, but you have the rest of the team here, which is cool because Don, as we were talking before we called you up, had worked on the series for quite a while and had a good relationship with Jeff Johns whenever he was working on the book and being invested in the characters. Did you lean on Don? And maybe Don, you can answer this as well. You know, what was the relationship with you guys as far as you know, maybe some character moments or character development in the series?
I relied on Don a lot. I'm sorry, Don, go ahead.
I was gonna say, only for a couple character moments. Otherwise, he pretty much, I think, really had it down, though. But there was just a few times where the action from what I knew of the characters kind of dictated certain things to happen a little differently. And I'd call him up or email Eric, and he was always, you know, very willing to listen to some of the ideas that I had, though, so which were good. So, no, I mean, I was happy that he was listening to my ideas instead of no, go draw Monkey Boy. You know?
Yeah. Well, Eric, were you happy that you were getting an artist that obviously had some a track record with the JSA?
I couldn't be happier. The fact of the matter is, I mean, I was aware of the characters and their history, and I had read some of the prior material, but I had kind of fallen away from it for the last couple of years, so I was really lost on a couple of the characters initially when they said, oh, by the way, it's a JSA book. I had my moment of, you know, screaming night terrors.
Oh, shit, I got a lot to read.
You weren't the only one in a couple of the new ones.
I crammed as much as I could. I mean, one of the advantages of my wife owning a comic store is I have access to an awesome reference library, but you know, Don is kind of underplaying a little bit. We didn't talk, like get on the phone an awful lot during the creation of the scripts. And there were a couple moments where, yeah, he was spot on, right? Like, no, this character wouldn't do that. He'd do this, or it would be this other character doing whatever. But the whole, like, issue four, that bit of business with Jakeem Thunder wouldn't have happened had Don not said, oh, hey, I'm really fond of this character. The whole bit in the subway tunnels with Cobra, triggering the, is this spoiler? Are we spoiler friendly at this point?
Oh yeah, yeah. We're good.
Yeah. That whole bit of business actually came about, like, he and I just chatting briefly, like, oh, what character do you, you know, I said, I've got 20 million characters to work in here. I'm obviously not going to get everybody's favorite in. You're the poor guy who has to draw 4 million characters every issue. Is there one you like more than the other, so I can make at least make that more pleasant? And he had expressed a fondness for JJ, and we just sort of got talking a little bit. And I don't even remember exactly how it came about, but that whole scene kind of popped into my head. It was like, oh, we totally have to do this. And that's got to be my favorite moment in the series.
Very cool.
Wouldn't have happened had we not been, you know, working well together. I was very pleased by that.
I love Jakeem Thunder. Yeah, he's one of my favorite JSA members.
I didn't realize that I had that much of a hand in it, because I knew you were telling me a little bit at the time. I remember you were talking about you were going to take them to Central City? Fawcett City.
Shut your mouth, Don. No, it's Fawcett City.
It's awful. Yeah. I'll have a friend of mine that's going to want to smack me for that, because he's a huge Captain Marvel fan. So. But you were telling me that you were going to take them to Fawcett City, and I didn't realize it. I guess we just kind of played off each other with that. I didn't realize that had a hand in the story. So, but
I had a different resolution in mind. I knew Jason was going into the subway tunnels and was going to steal a piece of the statues. But it wasn't until you kind of put out the, you know, I like Jakeem, and I was like, Jakeem, the Thunderbolt, Lightning, Fawcett City, subway tunnels, perfect.
Yeah.
a lot of what sparked that scene too was, at this point, you know, I think this was around issue, you were probably drawing issue two or, yeah, it was probably issue two at that point. And I had a better handle on kind of how you were approaching pages. And,
okay.
So I was like, oh, now I, you know, that I try and write scripts that play towards my illustrator's strengths. You know, your strengths were many and varied. So I was like, ooh, the gloves are off now. Awesome. So hopefully I didn't break your hands or anything. But
well, as the series gets ready to wrap up here, have they solicited a trade for the poor people that put off picking up the series in single issues?
I believe they have. Yeah.
Awesome.
At least the Amazon page for it is up. I don't even think there's cover art or anything. I presume it'll just be the issue one cover that Gene Ha did. So I know that the trade is coming, and it's filtered into the public awareness via Amazon. I don't think it's up on the DC site yet.
Very cool, but it may be coming to a finer comic book shop near you, which you had just mentioned a minute ago that your wife owns a comic shop. And congratulations to is it Olympia Comics and Cards for being named
Olympic Cards and Comics.
Olympic Comic or Cards and Comics.
Get it right, Chris.
For being named best comic shop in your region, right?
Yeah, King 5 is one of the larger regional TV stations based out of Seattle. You know, it's kind of a statewide station, and they do a Best of Western Washington competition annually, which I am told is kind of a big deal locally. There's TV coverage and you know, ridiculous amount of internet coverage for the winners of that. There's, you know, all sorts of categories, restaurants and bands and, you know, there's probably literally 100 categories, but yeah, my wife's store came in first.
That was awesome.
Very cool.
Congratulations.
That's fantastic.
Well, besides JSA Cobra, before we wrap up here, want to get all the quick hits here. Besides JSA Cobra, you are also writing The Shield currently, correct?
Yep. That's correct.
Yeah, let's talk about that character. There's an interesting another Jack Kirby character, Joe Simon, a Jack Kirby character, but you know, and this amalgam of all the different iterations of the Shield that have come in the past from the Archie line, and now in your hands and stuff. What excites you about this character?
Well, one thing I like about doing the book is I'm like, JSC versus Cobra, there's a lot fewer characters.
Sure.
I'm jealous.
we should talk then, Don. One of the things I like about the character, aside from the history, the history of the character is compelling to me because I'm kind of a total comics nerd, and I have a soft spot for characters that have a long legacy. He's still active duty military. I have, particularly on my wife's side of the family, there's, my father-in-law is a retired lieutenant colonel. My late brother-in-law was a Green Beret.
Wow.
Another one of my wife's brothers was a West Pointer. And in our store, we have a lot of customers that come off of Fort Lewis and McChord Air Force Base. So I'm surrounded by soldiers and airmen and Marines a lot. And military matters have always interested me, which should come as no surprise to anyone who's read my stuff.
And you know your weapons, from what I remember from the scripts he would send.
Yeah.
Red flag.
I'm a gun bunny. but I talk to these guys a lot, and what part of the fun for me was, a good friend of mine, he actually got a thanks in the first issue, is an active duty. He's also a Green Beret and assault medic and sniper and like really cool guy. I mean, he's a walking action figure. And kind of talking about the character with him and getting certain aspects of the mindset, I hope, right. So he comes across as something other than watered down Captain America for DC or right wing, jingoistic, symbolic character or blame America first left wing kind of character. I really wanted to avoid the political stuff and get more into the why these guys fight mindset and still have it be, really rip roaring superhero stuff. And that for me is the thing I'm most excited about is getting to do something a little different with a character that could very easily be very cookie cutter.
So there's not going to be a healthcare issue?
An issue with the Shield? I make no promises. The only thing I promise is the only promise I make for my run on the series is he will not be gunned down by an assassin's bullet on courthouse steps.
On
courthouse steps. Emphasis.
But that's what's interesting is his military background is different from Steve Rogers or Sergeant Rock, and the way that he operates as a superhero does come from this military background, were you Greg's military?
Greg says that you're his dirty tricks guy.
Yeah,
one of his dirty tricks guys.
That's kind of
I'm one of his dirty tricks guys. He has several folks he talks to about military stuff. I know one guy in particular. I believe he is British or Australian. I think that's his primary go-to guy for that stuff. But
don't give up too much information, or we'll have to be killed. Is what I've been told.
But that's why Queen and Country and Checkmate were interesting from an educational standpoint, and really exploring the intelligence side of, in the case of Checkmate, how the DC universe works from a global intelligence standpoint. And we're getting that same vibe now from the military in the Shield. And it's it's a facet that I don't think has really been explored that much in comics, because you would either have a straight up military guy like Sergeant Rock or one of the other, war heroes, or you'd have Captain America, who, had his training in, but if it wasn't a World War II story, it was Cap fighting the secret, Serpent Society or somebody, or the Red Skull with the Cosmic Cube or something like that. So
I tend to refer to that, my shorthand for that is, they're either unpowered, straight-up soldier boys, or they're in the obeying orders is optional military. And that makes me nuts. I hate that. I mean, that's actually one of the things I find really interesting about the Shield. Joe's a lieutenant. I mean, he's not a Green Beret. He doesn't have ridiculous special forces training before he gets the suit and stuff. I mean, he's you know, he's a well-trained American serviceman, but he's not a particularly high-ranking one. So he's going to have a different approach to problem solving than Captain America would, than Agent Liberty would, than, you know, and you pick patriotic superhero, you know, of your choice. He's going to behave differently than most of them because his background and his training and his mindset is going to advocate specific kinds of problem solving. And on top of that, you know, Marco's just drawn the hell out of that book. So
eventually, are the other Red Circle heroes, are they all going to come together, or will they be their, you know, their own separate stories? I know that there are flavors of a connected story.
Mm-hmm. The Web.
The Web, Inferno, and the Hangman, and all of these things. And certainly that was the way Straczynski at least introduced the characters. But will we see them working together at some point?
No comment.
All right, fair enough. Fair enough.
Very good.
Man,
if Matthew Sturgis just took over, or will be taking over the Web.
Okay.
At some point. And he called me the other day, and, you know, neither one of us had time to chat much, but the takeaway from that was we were both like, yeah, we have to start building this corner of the universe. I mean, I in terms of Inferno, you haven't seen it yet because you've only seen two issues, but, mm-hmm. you know, Jerwa and I work together all the time. You know, I mean, he's a really good friend of mine.
Cool.
We talk almost daily. It's, you know, it's inevitable that Inferno and S.H.I.E.L.D. are going to cross paths at some point. And it makes sense because, hey, they're in the same book.
Certainly.
You know, I don't know if this will manifest or even end up being approved by DC, but just kind of one of the takeaways from chatting with Matt was my own kind of personal opinion is that the Web and the Shield and the Web should sort of be the world's finest team for the Red Circle.
Very cool.
The Red Circle characters. So, like, when they do get together, it should be awesome. You know,
sure.
It should really be resonant and mythic and big and. He seemed pretty down on that. So
nice. Matt's a good guy. We've had him on the show before, and he's one of these you know, younger up and coming writers right alongside you and folks Brandon like Jerwa. Brandon Jerwa, you know, Brian Reed, Rick Remender. I mean, this great new class of writers coming in, and it's really exciting to see. Oh, the Web inked by Chicagoan Hilary Barda, by the way. So go check that out. So
these characters in general, I mean, they're just good ciphers that for years the various people that have had the license have, you know, tried to still keep it all ages and stuff, and it's a shame because, God, look at the pedigree that created these characters and stuff. I mean, literally, Joe Simon, Jack Kirby. I mean, mm-hmm. these wonderful creators. And, you know, I say this in general about how this is a great time in comics because we can have more sophisticated characterization and stories, adults writing for adults.
If the concept is good, then you can do some amazing things.
Yeah.
And that's what these Red Circle characters are right.
There's
up.
A, well, yeah. That's what I mean. There's a basic outline here that is wonderful to imprint a new characterization and a new direction that has never been explored before, and yet these are well known enough characters that I think people would be interested to see what's next for them in this new age.
There you go.
All right.
So
all
good,
right.
Good going.
And speaking of Mr. Jerwa, I did notice that you blew up Jerwa Avenue in JSA Cobra. So way to go.
I forget. I was doing a different podcast, and they had done a, you know, you know, post to Twitter your questions, and we'll ask them. And he had posted the question. I see that you blew up. You named a street after me in Metropolis, and then destroyed it. Why did you do that? That's mean. and of course, my answer wasn't any nicer. I said, "Well, Freud said every dream is a wish," but. that's kind of a game. Actually, have you guys read the latest issue of Detective Comics?
Oh my gosh, yes, so good. It broke my heart, man. So good.
The name of Kate's mom, And Gabby, that's my wife.
Oh, oh wow. Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, that's fucked up. My wife. Yes. There's a log line for your podcast.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, hey, Gabby, look. Yeah, Greg shot you in the head.
In the next issue of The Shield, a man named Greg Rucka gets beaten to death for 15 pages.
My wife is a huge fan of Batman and Wonder Woman and stuff. And so being the tragedy that informs the decision of somebody to put on the bat suit, I think she was really tickled by.
That's cool. So, that's cool. Yeah, it was
her honor to be killed in a Batman story. Yeah.
Thank you so much for killing me. All right, well, Mr. Troutman, we're gonna let you go here, but please know that you are welcome back anytime, and would love to talk with you again at length, and know that you're always welcome here, man.
Awesome. What are you doing tomorrow?
There
I'm
you
basically
go.
Comic book shut in. You understand that, right?
I'm going now, apple picking.
Yeah, you can go apple picking with Tom and his wife.
Yes. There's a corn maze.
That's the clincher.
You'll leave me out there, won't you?
Oh, I will. No, I'll leave my wife out there. Listen, when the shit hits the fan in that corn maze, I'm getting out of there.
It's every man for himself.
It's Halloween. Come on.
No, when you get lost in the maze, you
thanks
just
for having
straight.
Me on, guys.
All right. Thanks. You, Eric. We will talk to you soon, all right, man?
Good to hear from you again, Eric.
Right.
Take care, man.
Take care.
Nice talking to you, Don.
Yeah, I'll give you a call. You're always welcome.
All right. Well, we certainly want to thank Mr. Eric Troutman for chiming in with us there. It's a long overdue conversation. I mean, his stuff with Greg on Checkmate was outstanding.
Hell yeah.
And JSA versus Cobra has been a fantastic continuation of that, even though he says it's not. As a reader, it's really nice to get a flavor of Checkmate being continued on.
Well,
and I've enjoyed that.
And a different stripe for the JSA. I mean, sure. I love the JSA, and I love what Jeff set up, and mm-hmm. you know, am watching
more as a first strike team.
Exactly, yeah. That's the thing. It's an action book, and that's kind of what's been missing, I think, in JSA. They've had those big, you know, problems to solve, but I really do want them kind of fighting more. And also, it's good to see Mr. Terrific getting more time. And you always hear he's this, you know, he's the third smartest man in the DC universe. Mm-hmm. Well, now we're really starting to see that more, and you're seeing him more as an action leader, yep. as well as just a.
Even though
it took him
three or four issues to kind of catch up. Well, catch up and figure out what was going on. It's this new Cobra is a really scary. Scary ass villain.
Yeah, it's I gotta say, he was when the initial story was told to me, it the way it struck me was to they're bringing the old Cobra into like a more Al-Qaeda-esque type organization, and at the end of this, which I don't want to give anything away, but you can see where it's going, you know. Yeah. And how much more sinister they are, you know.
If you have a chance, and I really hope that I know that DC probably won't do it, but I think it would behoove them to include the Faces of Evil Cobra special that came out, the one shot that Ivan Brandon did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it really redefined what Cobra was, and I think you maybe needed to read that before the JSA Cobra miniseries. It was so good, and this comes right on the heels of that. So good.
I thought I read, too, that they are retrading the old Cobra stuff, the stuff that Marty Pascoe did back in the day. And in my interviews with Marty, it turns out that he really did just kind of rewrite a Jack Kirby concept and tweaked it here and there in that, you know, the first issue was like 90% Kirby and he really just kind of had to tweak a couple things, and then the rest was Marty.
Wow.
But yeah, I think, you know, this is a really strong concept that I think, you know, back in the day that was part of the DC implosion and never got a chance to really, you know,
so many good ideas out there that maybe
and now they have a chance to
Guerrilla City comic.
You're waiting. It'll happen, Tom.
Solovar,
it'll
don't
happen.
Worry.
Don, would you like to draw a Guerrilla City comic, maybe on the side?
I'd love to.
Outside of Grodd and Solovar, are there any other Guerrilla City, like, citizens that we know.
Whatever
about?
Silver's wife was named, I forget.
Okay. And Talkie Tawny would come for dinner. Hi!
Hi.
See, Tom is one of the preeminent Flash experts, and he actually hosts a show called Tom versus the Flash, yeah. which you can check out twice weekly as he runs you through the history of the DC
Feels like
universe.
Three times, I gotta be honest. I just said that last time we talked, and that's the only reason why I
brought it up. I tried. My wife won't let me do three.
I know the feeling.
It's too tough.
My wife looked at me today, and she's like, don't you ever get tired of hearing your own voice?
No, you don't. That's the thing. You don't. I get sick of me talking. That's why Tom, I shut up to like
Do you ever get sick of hearing my voice? Because, you know, you can check out another podcast called 11 O'Clock Comics.
That is right. That is right.
Discretion is not...
No.
Thy name is not Chris.
Discretion, thy name is not Chris. Well, you can check that out on Thursdays or Fridays whenever Vince gets that edited. That's 11 O'Clock Comics. And, of course, our buddy Mr. John Suntress and Word Balloon, whenever you come out four times a month-ish.
Definitely four times a month, but mm-hmm. we usually try to go a little bit more than that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's usually
five or six.
Yeah, in between, you know, yeah.
I'd say between
six.
Five and eight. I'd
five,
say between five,
five
and
eight.
Eight.
Yeah, there are weeks where you go crazy. Yes, you go indeed. Crazy. Yes, and Mr. Don Kramer, you can find Don's stuff online at, is it donkramerart.com?
Yep, it's a, I haven't kept up with that website yet, but people can reach me there. You
there
know?
You go.
And,
there.
If it's GeoCities, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
GeoCities.com//Don/
/TML.
Also on like MySpace and Facebook and all that too.
Do you Twitter?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
No.
The Twitter will get you, which it's @Tom Caters, mm-hmm. @JohnWordBalloon,
correct.
@CNeesman. You can follow us all on Twitter. You can also follow @AroundComics, our buddies @iFanboy, and Ron is @RonXO, and all those folks. So hop on the Twitter.
Vince Bond is on there as well.
Vince Bond
I am now being followed by Vince Bond.
I know, it's kind of frightening, isn't
well,
it?
I haunt him enough on mm-hmm. message boards and phone messages. So that's
Jason and David from
that is right.
They're both there as well as a ton of other comic book creators
real comic creators.
Jeff Johns with updates about what flavor slushy he's going to give.
7-Eleven guy. Absolutely, man.
All right.
The people with talent.
He's been doing a lot of like the Smallville things lately. You know, because he's doing the JSA coming to Smallville.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hollywood.
Yep.
I hope we don't lose him. Last announcement. November 13th, 14th, and 15th at Challengers Comics, our other favorite store in Chicago, is going to have an art sale. That's going to go that weekend. There's going to be a ton of original art that is for sale.
Okay.
It starts on that Friday night. It's a 7 to 10 o'clock on that Friday night, November 14th or 13th. And that's kind of a wine and cheese art exhibit and sale. And proceeds from the art sale are going to help benefit Hero Initiative, a percentage of the sales. And so it's going to go that entire weekend.
That's a big art comic weekend because also coming to town. Isn't it that same weekend that my buddies from Activate are coming to town?
They could be. Well, I know at the Challengers show that Tom Nagovin, your buddy, is going to be involved with.
Oh, that's nice.
He's donating some art to that.
Okay, and, that's cool. Because I know another store in town, Quinby's, is going to be. And actually, I don't know if that actually came through or not.
I don't know.
I was speaking with Dean Haspiel.
Dean Haspiel.
Yeah, and I know Activate is on tour, and I know that they were hoping to have Chicago be part of the tour.
Well, they better come to Chicago.
That was the idea, and
I was
pushing him to not only hit Quimby's but to hit our pals at Challengers as well. So I hope the love connection happened. I'll have to find out.
Well, I think that's
No, I said that would be great.
Yeah, I think that's it. We're going to wrap this one up. Everyone, thanks for listening, and we will be back again next week with another full length episode. In the meantime,
in between times,
thanks, sir.
Thank you, John.
We'll be everywhere in
and
around comics.
Comics. That is right. Can't help but ask.
Tinfoil hat.
That is right.
Right.
Yeah, I meant to ask. Actually.
views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2009.
This morning, blessed Reveille, woke from a dream where I was in a terrible realm. All my sails were ablaze, I was chained to the helm. Now I'm overwhelmed. Right lights, but these mocking words.